This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Mark Brenner, Sarah Chambers, who's a Caucus of Rank and File Educators member in Chicago. Veteran negotiator and author Joe Burns. But first, we're going to hear from Stephanie Luce, professor of labor studies at the City University of New York, who spent some time building solidarity between labor and community for the Occupy Wall Street movement.
We know wages play a huge role in explaining inequality in the U.S., and it affects inequality in several ways. So we have some policy tools to address it, and those can play a role. But the fact is, these policy tools are only as powerful as the social movements behind them. And they're really not, there's not policy to address these wage distribution questions and the maximum wage. And there's where I think we can really think to look to Occupy Wall Street for this more bolder social movements that we need to really address wage inequality. And I think, you know, in a way we can return to this, notion of the concept of a living wage and take apart that term. The idea of the wage is a kind of a technical term and an economic term, and there's a lot of calculations we can do to say how many calories do people need to survive, what are the average rents that we need to, you know, be able to pay. And those are important, but I think we shouldn't get too bogged down in the technicalities. There's never going to be one right answer as to what's the exact, you know, perfect minimum wage and so forth. I think we need to focus a lot more on the concept of living and what do we want our lives to be like? What should our world look like? And this is where I say we can look to Occupy Wall Street, because what we've really done, I think, what we've really seen Occupy Wall Street do is kind of combine these two elements. One is defensive struggles. Occupy Wall Street has been going out and doing strike support, defending people against foreclosures, really fighting to maintain the gains that we've made. But it's also insisted on this prefigurative notion to say, what is the other world we want to have? To say, what kind of world do we want to build? And we will not be constrained by the current parameters of our two-party system or by our Wall Street economy or by Citizens United. We will not let that constrain us in thinking about the kind of world we want to build, where people really have the ability to grow their capacities to the best of their ability to take care of one another. So I think in terms of wages, we want to do the same thing. We want to defend what we have. We want to raise the floor. But we really want to think about building another kind of world. And just to conclude by saying, remember that the term living wage was actually initially a concession, because the people who actually were talking about a living wage were talking about the alternative and saying, do we actually have to sell our labor for a wage in order to survive? Let's just question that notion. What about the notion that we have the right to survive without having to sell our labor? Can't we guarantee, you know, our existence without having to, you know, worry about our wage level? So I would say let's be inspired by Occupy Wall Street. Let's talk about the kind of world we want to build and, in fact, insist that another world is, in fact, possible.
That was Stephanie Luce on the trajectory of the wage dialogue. Mark Brenner spoke to the role he felt the media played in how organized labor finds itself cast as the villain in the court of public opinion. How would you characterize the current state of organized labor?
Well, I'd say we're in a pickle. We've been really squeezed by the economic crisis. Even before the meltdown in 2008, working people have been under the gun, and unions in particular have been a steady target for corporations and increasingly, you know, governments to try and put a wrecking ball to what we have left in terms of working class organization. And so that's just accelerated since 2008. And I would say we're really all hands on deck in terms of making sure that the labor movement makes its way into a better and brighter future.
What role do you believe mainstream media has played in that situational circumstance, if you will?
Well, I think that especially since 2009, you've seen a really interesting shift. You know, right after the economic meltdown in 2008, everyone across the country was really clear that it was the sort of top corporate executives and the bankers who were really at fault for our mortgage meltdown and for the financial crisis. You know, everybody understood that the bankers and the CEOs were the ones who got us into this mess. And then I think the media played a really pernicious role in shifting the focus after 2000 and 2009, you know, after the immediate crisis for the banks was over, onto working people, in particular public sector workers, and really creating a kind of them versus us sentiment among working people. You know, like, I don't have a union, and I don't have a pension, and I don't have employer-paid health care. Why should you have that? And really fed a lot of the animosity, particularly towards government workers, and I think that continues to this day. I think we see teacher bashing and postal worker bashing, and I think that, you know, we're going to see another round of auto worker bashing in the very near future. It's just, it's really, really been, in my mind, a shameful betrayal of what the media's role should be in a democratic society.
What are the best tools for effective networking, and what impact have 21st century technologies had on organizing?
Well, I think that it's played a really interesting role in two ways. One is, inside of unions, we're seeing members able to communicate with each other a lot more directly, a lot more frequently, and a lot more deeply, thanks to new technologies like Facebook and Twitter. I remember during the 2011 strike at Verizon, there were thousands and thousands of Verizon workers who were debating in very lively and elaborate detail the strategy of the union and pros and cons of going back to work without a contract. And so we saw a level of engagement with each other that wasn't really possible before the kind of technology that we now have. And I think the same is true with organizing. The best example is probably Walmart. We're seeing workers who work for Walmart or have worked at Walmart able to connect to each other and connect to people who are trying to organize Walmart in ways that they just couldn't have done even 5 years ago. So in that sense, it's helped people to get information, to find each other, to connect. But I think it's really just enhanced. It's just another tool, you know, in the same way a cell phone's a tool, the same way that the phone itself was a tool in our organizing. And it's really no substitute for relationship building and the kind of real trust that you need to do scary things like stand up to your boss and building that collective will to take those risky actions. You know, you're not going to do that on Facebook alone. You really need to kind of connect on a human level with people. But it's expanded our ability to find one another, to communicate laterally, and to really kind of get information out. Certainly our reach as an alternative media project, which is part of what Labor Notes does, is really expanded dramatically with the advent of some of these social media technologies.
And can you tell me, what do you believe events like Troublemaker School have to offer with regard to what organized labor needs?
Organized labor is really in quite a state of disarray. We're under constant attack from corporations and increasingly from elected officials. And I think that what's been really inspiring to me, despite the hardships of the last 5 years, is that the interest and the hunger for ways to organize and ways to fight back has just exploded. We've never seen more interest in the kind of nuts and bolts of how to organize against your boss, how to get together with your coworkers and stand up for your rights that we've seen since the crisis. And what that tells me is that whether you're talking about the unionized workforce or the non-union workforce, that there's a real hunger to figure out how to get, you know, more of what we deserve, not just what we'll settle for. And so I think, you know, it's in that spirit that we started organizing these local one-day, what we call troublemaker schools, as a way to really help people in local areas connect with each other, get some real nuts and bolts skills, recharge your batteries, because I think one of the things that at least in my experience from doing this for a long time, is that it's really grueling and really hard to, you know, stay in the struggle for the long term. And getting together with folks who are of a like mind and have, you know, similar interests in organizing working people for a bigger voice and a stronger role in the way that our society functions, can really give you that shot in the arm that you need sometimes to get back out there into the fight. And so, you know, for all those reasons, we've been expanding the one-day troublemaker schools that we've been doing since 2008. And it's been amazing. We just meet so many wonderful people, and we, you know, really see the best of what you know, working people, union and non-union, can do when they have the space and the time to put their mind to collective activity.
One of the Troublemaker School topics is about beating apathy. Can you lay out for me what you see in terms of causes and remedies?
Well, I think that apathy seems pretty pervasive to most people who are organizing and who are trying to get people to do things. I think it's one of the most common kind of problems that union activists identify. And I take a fairly controversial view on apathy. I don't actually think people are apathetic. I think that most people, the vast majority of people, care pretty strongly about a lot of things. It's our job as organizers to find out what it is that they care very strongly about and really critically figure out a way to inspire confidence that we have a concrete plan that can actually change for the better the things that they're very passionate about, the things that they care about. Because I think people are also pretty rational. You know, if you see people stick their neck out and get it cut off, then, you know, you're disinclined to stick your neck out. But the more you get a sense of, you know, winnability and confidence that, you know, we have a plan, we can organize together in a way that will actually provide concrete results and not get us, you know, tied up in knots with our employers, I think people are much more likely to engage. And so a lot of what beating apathy is about is figuring out how to, number one, identify what it is that people care about and, you know, they feel deeply, you know, issues that they feel deeply about. And number two, really craft what we call a plan to win, to actually get some concrete results on the issues that people feel so deeply about. And if you can do those two things, I've seen it in my own organizing and I've seen it time and time again in other people's stories. From the across the labor movement and across the activist scene, that that apathy melts away.
My own contention is as follows. I don't think people are so much apathetic anymore. They can look around and they can see the destitution, the desperation. What we have to battle now is atrophy.
Oh, and that couldn't be a better diagnosis of what's going on with the labor movement. Really, for the last 30 years, we've been very poorly exercised, and our muscles are atrophied. And that's one of the problems that we're really also trying to address with these troublemaker schools, is to really help people get some of that muscle memory back about what it's like to stand up and fight. Because I think that if you don't have an experience acting together with your coworkers, confronting the powerful, actually standing up for your rights, it's something that you got to learn and you got to practice. And so we're just trying to kind of sow the seeds and get people exercising those muscles, because the more you exercise it, the stronger you get, the more you can do. And that's very much, you know, our theory as well on how we, you know, start to rebuild some of the working class power that we've lost in this country.
That was Mark Brenner on How to Beat Apathy. Author of Reviving the Strike, How Working People Can Regain Power and Transform America, Joe Burns provides an interesting historical narrative to identify the components of and develop criteria for strategies that succeed. Can you tell me, what do you feel are the pivotal developments that have led organized labor to where it is?
I mean, we can really look at over the last 80 years, employers have been able to reshape labor law to outlaw effective strike activity. And it's led to a situation where trade unions are fighting with their hands behind, tied behind their backs. It makes it extremely difficult to win strikes nowadays. So basically, when employers launched this offensive against trade unionism in the 1980s in the private sector, unions tried to fight back, but they kept on losing strikes, and eventually unions just quit striking. And what we found over the last 15, 20 years is, without a strike, trade unions aren't really able to leverage enough power to force employers to improve workers' lives. So we've had a declining labor movement.
And why is what happened in Wisconsin, which has been described as disappointing, significant in terms of how much support there is or isn't currently for organized labor?
I mean, I think in what we see in Wisconsin was that was a grassroots upsurge where ordinary working people showed up at the Capitol. They were able to occupy the state capitol for weeks, and over 100,000 workers would be marching around the state capitol. So it was really, that's really the amazing part about the Wisconsin struggle to me, and it really shows hope for the future of the labor movement. Because if you look at when labor has grown throughout history, it's been through these massive upsurges of worker self-activity, such as in the 1960s when hundreds of thousands of public workers all across the country, even in unlikely places, engaged in illegal strike activity and really won public employee unionism. And a similar process happened in the 1930s. So that's really, to me, that's really what Wisconsin points to. I think in the aftermath of that, you had a turn towards a legislative solution, which didn't work. But the beginning of it was very inspirational.
And in regard to the Troublemakers event here in Portland later this month, what are you hoping to see? What are you hoping to share?
I think the Troublemaker School is a great opportunity for trade unionists to get together and compare some strategies, but also talk about some of these bigger issues about how we're going to revive the labor movement. I'm going to be having a discussion there with trade unionists about reviving the strike, about the importance of the strike, and also how do we build a movement within the labor movement that really promotes strike activity and talks about what it takes to have an effective strike.
What do you see as criteria when trying to determine whether or not the efforts are successful as it applies to strikes and winning strategies? What does it look like and how do you know?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at it, you can look back through labor history and see what actually worked. And traditionally in labor history, unions were able to use workplace-based solidarity. They had a whole bunch of tactics, such as industry-wide strikes. They had what's called secondary boycotts, where workers at one workplace would go on strike in support of workers at another. So those were very effective tactics. They also engaged in a variety of tactics, such as mass picketing, where they basically said the employer shouldn't be able to operate during a strike, that pain should be felt on both sides, not just on the workers. So that was, for a long period of time, a very successful form of strike activity and created an entire way of life for people in the 50s and 1960s, for working people. So those were very effective strikes. In contrast, we have relatively ineffective strike methods that we employ today, where workers go out at one location, they stand on picket lines while replacement scabs go in and produce the products. So that's an ineffective strike. So what we need to do is look at labor history and see how can we start going back to effective strike activity.
That was Joe Burns talking about what elements make for effective strikes. I also spoke with Sarah Chambers. She's an education professional from Chicago, where the effort to close several schools has teachers, students, and parents up in arms and rallying to prevent the privatization of public education. She talked about how inspirational and informative Troublemaker School has helped her push back.
Every time you learn something new, new actions, new ways that unions are organizing, you know, bottom-up unions, that where workers can take actions on themselves. So it was really great. I think it's always inspiring. You know, you hear from people from all around the country. So I'm really excited for the conference. I've heard a lot of good things overall about Portland activists. So in the schools, I know there's a lot of student organizing. So I was interested to hear more about how the teachers in Portland are working with the students and how they've really built that up. Overall, just hearing from another side of the country, you know, we have the same oppression, same management techniques are happening all over the country, but there's different types of fight back. So it's interesting to hear the different techniques from other unions.
That was Sarah Chambers describing what she believes are the motives behind standardized testing and the pursuit of a school system that yields profit. This brief from the National Employment Law Project, published in February of this year, tracks the activities of the American Legislative Exchange Council and their efforts to engage in wage suppression. Since January of 2011, legislators from 31 states have introduced 105 bills reflecting Alec's, quote, model, unquote, legislation designed to suppress the wages of low-paid workers in the United States. These bills aim to repeal the state minimum wage laws, reduce wage rates for youth and tipped workers, weaken overtime compensation policies, and prevent local governments from establishing living wage ordinances. Of these 105 bills, 67 of them were directly sponsored or co-sponsored by ALEC-affiliated elected officials from 25 states. Labor seems under siege, and learning ways to resist such tyrannical tides is available this Saturday at 16021 Northeast Airport Way and begins at 9 a.m. For more information, contact Jamie Partridge at 503-752-5112 or visit labornotes.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you've been listening to Political Perspectives.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast live from the Inner City Blues Festival, Saturday, April 13th, from 7 to 10 p.m. Healthcare for All Oregon is throwing a party called the Inner City Blues Festival, Healing the Healthcare Blues, in the Groove of Love. Northwest Blues Stars are returning for a night of music that will benefit the work of statewide coalition Healthcare for All Oregon for universal, affordable healthcare for all Oregonians. KBOO is proud to help sponsor the Inner City Blues Festival to take place Saturday, April 13th at the Melody Ballroom, 615 Southeast Alder. Doors at 6 and KBOO's live broadcast starts at 7. More information can be found at kboo.fm/Inner City Blues Festival 2013.
Hey all you hip cats and kittens, this Thursday dig this crazy live radio play at the Clinton Street Theater. KBOO presents the world premiere of the musical radio play 10 Cents a Dance. There'll be song and dance, murder and mayhem with a solid cast led by Rebecca Kilgore, fresh from the Big Apple, and a swinging orchestra led by Ali Ippolito. All of this live on stage at the Clinton and broadcast on KBOO live. Written and directed by Dennis Nyback. A program of film shorts from the 30s and 40s will follow, all set in radio stations. See Cab Calloway, Kate Smith, Rudy Valley, Mel Blanc, Lucille Ball, and those Jumpin' Nicholas brothers. So hoof it on down to the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, this Thursday, April 11th at 7 p.m. for the K-Boo Radio Pictures presentation of 10 Cents a Dance. Advance tickets available at brownpapertickets.com.
There's a grave crisis happening just off the southern coast of the United States. The hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay prison camp has entered its third month, and reports say men have lost between 30 and 40 pounds, some slipping in and out of unconsciousness. JTF Gitmo officials call the hunger strike a weapon that men are using to manipulate the system. Join me, Linda Olson Osterlund, on a deeper look this Thursday morning, April 11th, at 9:30 a.m. It's a day of action to close Guantanamo and end indefinite detention. I'll be joined by Pardis Cabrillai of the Center for Constitutional Rights. That's the Guantanamo hunger strike and the day of action, this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Tuesday, April 10th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio, and 90.7 FM, KBOO.fm on the web. Well, as it happens, we have Ralph Schoenman back to finish the interview that we began. This will be the second part of a two-part program on Lynn Stewart's current situation. Also, WikiLeaks is launching a new campaign, and with the release of the Kissinger cables, that's today. More on that later on in the program. We also have the face of the prospect currently of cuts to the two most successful social programs in the history of the United States, Social Security and Medicare, at the same time as gun control is being debated, at the same time as North Korea is rattling its nuclear sabers across the Pacific, at the same time as the U.S. is actually contemplating the prospect of involving itself in Syria. Interestingly enough, there is a congressional hearing on drones coming up, and we have yet to cobble together any sort of legislation. Maybe it's a good time to think about that, since undoubtedly U.S. involvement in Syria will come at the tip of a finger of some 19-year-old buried in a bunker a mile underground in Nevada. Yeah, indeed, it'll be drone warfare if it's going to be anything. Before that, though, here in Cascadia, the National Weather Service has this for us: partly sunny. We've got partly sunny today's highs at 61, and Rain coming later in the afternoon. Tomorrow, highs near 59. Again, partly sunny and 50-50 odds of rain. Tomorrow night, lows around 48 and a bit of wind. And that's it for the conventional weather forecast. The unconventional, the alternative forecast, we have a new moon. It's a leaf moon in Pisces. And pretty much all of the forecasts that we had yesterday hold steady for today. So that's it for the conventional and the alternative forecast. And we want to get right into it, speaking right now with Nadia Kell with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, because we are in a very strange form of quagmire. It seems the U.S. has never really emerged from the swamps of decay post-Vietnam. And this time, of course, it's drone warfare, which has been going on for 10 years, without any sort of legislation. There is no legal architecture framing the use of drones domestically as well as farther afield. The Pakistanis know all too well what the effects of this have been, and they don't like it one bit, nor should they have to like any part of this. There is, of course, coming up a congressional hearing finally, but what choice do they have when we're faced with the prospect of getting ourselves somehow involved in Syria? Nadia Kell is with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and she joins us this morning. Good morning, Nadia. Thanks so much.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we are indeed living in some strange days. Even Oregon is contemplating a role as part of a three-state consortium designed to test drones, and their ad campaign features the fact that the consortium offers all kinds of different weather, and I suppose it's as with every